You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
I love talented people. I like being around talented people. Why not? I got a shot. Why not give others a shot?
I want to be a producer with a hit show on Broadway.
You're listening to the Producer's Perspective Podcast with your host, Tony Award winner, Ken Davenport.
I like what she's doing. This might be a thing. She's giving it feeling. She's making it.
That is this week's guest, the incredible Julie Halston from her hit Broadway musical Tootsie, playing in the background there. Very excited to chat with Julie today. But first, before we get to this very, very funny lady, this episode is sponsored by Sunlight Studios. With 8 bright and spacious studios for rent, you can rehearse your next Broadway hit knowing you're in good hands. To book a studio today at Sunlight, visit, sunlightstudios.com, just like it sounds, right in the heart of the theater district. It doesn't get more conveniently located than Sunlight Studios. And if you want to save some bucks, use code Davenport. I wonder where they got that. Use code Davenport to receive a 5% discount on all bookings until October 10th, 2019. Again, use code Davenport, save some bucks. We all want to keep our budgets down. You can do that at Sunlight Studios. Very conveniently located in the heart of the theater district. Thanks, Sunlight, for sponsoring this week's episode with Julie Halston.
Man, I love. To be fair, dear, you did kill the last one. Julia, don't I deserve a chance at a future that celebrates me? Oh, this is really good.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hello, everybody. You're listening to the Producer's Perspective Podcast. I am Ken Davenport. And you know, for many years on this podcast, I have been an idiot because I have failed to have many performers as guests. Well, we're changing that now. And I am very excited about today's guest because it's one of my favorite performers. She is not only super talented, but she is also the epitome of what I call an entrepreneur, someone who's responsible for taking her career in her own hands and making it happen. Please welcome to the podcast the incredible Julie Halston. Welcome, Julie.
Well, I am very happy to be here.
So Julie is currently starring on Broadway in Tootsie, that big old hit over at the Marquee. Additional Broadway credits, we could be here like all day reading this stuff, but a few: On the Town, You Can't Take It With You, Hairspray, The Women, and a bunch more, including Gypsy.
Yes.
Which is where I first met her when I company managed that show. Every night you made me laugh. Every night.
Oh, and that was with Bernadette Peters, you know, Broadway royalty, Sam Mendes, our director. It was an incredible cast, and we at Gypsy, you know, still do reunions. We're all still really close friends.
Except, obviously, for me, because I'm never invited to
them. Well, that's true. Company management, you know. However, the cast still gets together. In fact, Jenna Gavigan, who was a child, who was one of the Toreadorables, who is now, like, you know, a 30-year-old woman, was in my dressing room just the other night. I'm going to go see Brooks Eshmankis in The Prom next week. Heather Lee, who lives in Los Angeles, she's still one of my best friends. This all came about in 2003, Gypsy with Bernadette Peters.
Well, at Broadway, you've done other stuff besides Broadway, of course, as well. A ton of TV and film. You've won like 4 MAC Awards for your cabaret show.
Right.
You have done it all. So you're obviously known for being a big comedian.
Yes.
Were you... What came first? Were you like making people laugh like out of the womb? Were you always like cracking people up?
That's really what happened. I graduated from Hofstra University, in 1868. The Civil War was going on. But I graduated from Hofstra, and I actually came to New York thinking I was going to be a very serious actress. You know, the fact that I had a very deep Long Island accent, I didn't care. I thought I was going to be Hedda Gabler. But I studied at the Terry Schreiber Studio, who's a very good, really one of the better acting coaches and teachers, and has been doing it for many years. And he was the very first person to actually say, I actually think you're really funny. Because I think he would hear me talking to, on our breaks.
Not even in a scene.
Just talking, to other actors. And so that kind of got me thinking. But on the other hand, I was still very devoted to the idea that I was going to be a very classical actress. Meanwhile, I had no classical training. Didn't stop me. I thought.
What did you study at Hofstra?
I studied performance, but I had done an all-female version of Waiting for Godot. This was all serious stuff, and things like that. Viet Rock by Megan Terry. All these kind of 60s and 70s kind of. Very, a little bombastic, theater. Then I ended up, and of course, brilliantly, thank God, through a mutual friend, meeting Charles Bush, who happened to be a one-man band performer who wanted to write a play, was desperate to just do something, wrote a little sketch called Vampire Lesbians of Sodom. Everyone turned him down.
Everybody.
As a co-lead, including his own sister. She was like, I'm not doing that on the Lower East Side. Remember, this is the 1980s. The Lower East Side was like Berlin after the war. It was really a crack den place. And I had met him through a mutual friend. And I was like, well, I'll do it. But here's where it all became something really interesting. We did start our own theater company. Ken Elliott, our director, was the one who said, we need to actually, because it became very successful, we need to be our own company. We're not getting work through the usual route. Get an agent and just, we weren't the Juilliard people. We weren't the, NYU people. We were, sort of like the outsiders. And so we did. We formed our own theater company. And it was actually through that, when we would be in these crazy dressing rooms, which weren't even really dressing rooms, like in an alley. And Charles was the one who said to me, you're really funny, and you should write things down. And you should eventually do something with that. Mm-hmm. I was like, yeah. I was just yakking, making the cast laugh.
Not even on stage so much. They're just watching.
Talking and, putting our, makeup on or whatever. And I'm like, oh, you wouldn't believe what my mother said to me today. Blah, blah, blah. And they'd be howling. And anyway, we did eventually become a rather successful off-Broadway company. Success for us meant, $200 a week. I think that's what I earned, really. And I was thrilled. I, however, had a day job. I still worked on Wall Street. I was a...
Wall Street?
Yes. I was a librarian for an investment counsel firm called Brundage Story & Rose. And my boss is now one of my dearest friends and my financial advisor. See, this is how life works in a circular route.
First of all, you as a Wall Street librarian sounds like a sketch in itself.
It was like a sketch in itself. It really was. I was desperate for a job. But that was my day job. And then at night, I would leave the office at 6:30 after the market had closed and race downtown to do Vampire Lesbians of Sodom. I got 4 hours of sleep a night and didn't matter. I was young, I was in my 20s. This is what you do. You're like, I can't seem to get onto Broadway. We've got this theater company. We're just doing it on our own. We never thought about we're gonna get, big reviews and this is gonna turn into, I'm gonna get my own TV series or whatever. We were just having a blast, working with a playwright that we thought was just a fun, interesting person who would write these parodies of all these different genres of film. You know, the film noir, or Gidget Goes Psychotic, which was the original name of Psycho Beach Party. So all these parody shows became wildly successful. And it was when we were doing this in our dressing room, and at that point we actually did have real dressing rooms, Charles said to me, you need to do a one-woman show. You need to do a one-woman show. Just saying the things that you say here. Mm-hmm. I said, no, I can't do that. That's for stand-ups, you know, I'm an actress. Again, I took myself very seriously, even though I was in Vampire Lesbians of Sodom.
I do want to see you play Hedda Gabler someday. That's all I can think about.
Now, exactly. Well, you'll have to produce it.
But listen, before you go into your show, I want to go back to one thing you said about Charles Bush getting turned down by everyone. And by the way, for the listeners out there, Charles was on the podcast, and it's an amazing one. So look it up and listen to it. But everyone's turning him down, and you said yes. And I'm a big believer that in the beginning of your career, you should just say yes a lot.
A lot of things.
I want to know what it was. Did you see something in Charles? Were you just like, I'll do anything? What was it about Charles that you saw?
Okay, so I did skip one little element, which is before I ended up doing Vampire Lesbians of Sodom, he had invited me to his one-man show at the Shondell Theater, which I think is now a parking lot. It's not even, doesn't exist. It was rat-infested. It was a nightmare. He had no audience. He knew that I had a lot of friends. So he invited me. He said, look, I'll pay for your tickets. I need an audience. Would you just come and bring people to this one-man show of mine? It was called Charles Bush, Alone with a Cast of Thousands. And he played both men and women. This is like in 1983. And I fell in love with him. I thought he was creative, fascinating. I loved that he was playing women and men with just like a one little prop, maybe a hat or a scarf or a fan. He wasn't even in full drag or anything like that. But I found him very alluring. Many of my friends also thought it was hilarious, and many of my friends go, we don't get it. We didn't get it. But they saw a show for free, so they didn't care. But I got, you know, I would bring audience to Charles, and I just fell mad for him. I just thought he was great. So that's why I ended up saying yes.
So you just saw an artist that you saw something special, and you're like, I'm going to be around this guy.
I want to be around this guy. I just want to hitch myself to this train because I think it's fun. Again, it wasn't like, oh, well, this will get me a big career or this is our Tony Award, you know. No, it was just, wow, he's interesting. That was one of the smartest decisions I ever made.
Yeah, he becomes this great mentor for you, obviously. And
exactly.
Pushed you to writing your own stuff.
Exactly.
So tell us how that happened.
So we're in our dressing room, and this is when we had been doing Vampire Lesbians of Sodom quite a while. And at that point, I think I actually did have an agent. I was starting to branch out a little. But he was the one who said, you know, you've just got to do your own thing. You're funny. And you keep us laughing. And, you know, I bet you could write something. I didn't believe him. And he said, well, you better do it because I've booked you in a club.
What?
And I was like, what? He said, yeah. Guess what? You're doing in 2 weeks, you're going to 88's on 10th Street. I've booked you. Irv Rabel, the proprietor, has booked you, and it's a Monday night, and I'm telling people all about it. So you better write a show in 2 weeks.
2 weeks?
I literally, I don't know how I got on stage that night.
But you did. I mean, forget how you got on stage. So you said, okay, you're going to do it?
Said yes again. And I said, Charles, what am I going to talk about for 50 minutes? He goes, well, call your mother up. That's a start. So I did. I called her up and I just was like, Ma, how are you? And she was like, well, you wouldn't believe what's been going on in the neighborhood. And and I wrote everything down that she said. And then my mother was a big matinee lady. She used to come to the theater a lot. She loved the theater. And she would always tell me her reviews. So, of course,
I am laughing already.
Well, I mean, my mother, she was like, you know, Mary and I, we went to see, you know, Gemini or whatever would she would see. Oh, she loved musicals, but she would go to everything, quite frankly. Oh, well, I mean, I hope I don't offend her because I'm a big fan of hers. But she was like, do you know that Christine Baranski? And I said, well, I don't really know her personally, Mom, but she's very talented. She goes, I find her cold. I said, Mom, I think you're talking about the character she was playing. She was like, well, regardless, left me cold. But I'm going to tell you someone who's going to be a very big star. My mother predicted this so many years ago. She goes, someone named Nathan. And then she like looked it up. She had the playbills. She goes, his name is Nathan Lane, and he's going to be enormous. And she was the one who told me that. So I would just write down everything that she would say. And I would say I had at least 15 minutes. And then one of the things that I used to do, and this is as far back as like 1980, I was obsessed with the New York Times wedding announcements. They were very, very, particularly in the early days, they were very, very pretentious. And everyone was very, you know, everyone had three names. Everyone was a, you know, Raymond Porter III, you know, and they were very, very formal. And I could somehow glean real comedy out of these things. And, you know, they would talk about what the bride was going to be wearing, you know, her grandmother's veil, a silk dubioni, you know, train, and blah, blah, blah. And I just thought this was the most pretentious, crazy stuff. And I am still to this day reading in my act the New York Times wedding announcement.
So you just read them? I just read them.
I literally created a show a number of years ago, and I was like nominated for awards for it, called Julie Halston, Queen of Readings. And Ken, I just read things. But I had to have
it. You are the actress that can read the phone book. You can do it.
I literally read from Vogue, from my Baltimore Catechism, from my diary, from the New York Times wedding announcements. And Charles was the one who said, well, I've booked you. You're doing it. Mm-hmm. It sold out. I ran that show for 2 years. Wednesday nights and Saturday, and we would sell out. And this is the thing that was so great. I was able to, and I didn't know that this was going to happen, meld a cabaret career and a one-woman show kind of career with a theatrical career. And it was at that time, so because now it's like the late 80s, early 90s. Billy Stritch, Jim Caruso, Ann Hampton Calloway, Liza Minnelli, she would hang out at 88s. All these people, Julie Gold, Judy Gold, so comedians were starting to get into these club situations as well. That brought casting agents like Jim Carnahan down to these clubs. Scott Ellis first saw me at 88s because he was friends with Liza Minnelli because he did a show with Liza Minnelli. So suddenly there was this blend of cabaret world people, theatrical people, and I literally was able to create a one-person show from the cabaret space world. It brought in casting agents so that now I'm being cast in like Law and Order or, you know what I mean, TV things, like as a guest star. And then off-Broadway producers started coming into the situation. And suddenly I was told, hey, we think this show could go off-Broadway. And Ken Elliott, who was our director for Charles Busch's show, said, I'll direct it. And we created a show called Julie Halston's Lifetime of Comedy. It was nominated for an Outer Critics Circle Award. Drew Dennett was my producer. Dale Lawrence, his girlfriend at the time, she was in our company. She got investors. It ran off Broadway, and I got a TV development deal out of it for CBS. And I did a pilot called Those Two with Harvey Fierstein. And it was the precursor to Will and Grace. 9 years before Will and Grace.
This is amazing. This is what, so correct me if I'm wrong, but what I love doing is weaving these threads through people's careers. But because you said yes to Charles Bush, all those dominoes fell. And if for some reason you didn't say yes,
he might have paid his sister a lot of money to play his co-star.
You'd be making a lot of people at that Wall Street firm laugh really hard.
The Christmas library party would be a scream, but I wouldn't have a career as an actress. And do you know, Ken, I still say yes to everything.
Well, you're here, for God's sake. You said yes to me. It's a perfect example. You were like, yes, I don't know what this podcast is, but okay.
No, but I do. I say yes. Unless there's such a red flag around it, I say yes to readings when I can. I say yes to workshops when I can. I say yes. I literally just produced, you must know about this, I just produced an industry reading for a friend of mine who wrote a show, which I can't say on the podcast, but it's about the Wright brothers and it's hilarious. I just said yes. I love talented people. I like being around talented people. Why not? I got a shot. Why not give others a shot? That's what this whole community is about. That's why I love being part of the Broadway and off-Broadway community. It's a community. And it's hard enough out there. Why not keep the ball going, particularly if you believe in people's work? I believed in what Charles Bush was doing. Now, if I saw his show and I was like, ooh, I don't think this guy has any talent, maybe I would not have said yes to Vampire Lesbians. But I was gobsmacked. I thought he was hilarious. I thought he was talented. I also loved that he was playing male and female roles. Instead of it being confusing or strange to people, I thought it was great. I thought, wow, that shows he even more range. Talented people excite other talented people. And you know, it's so interesting. Yes, there's a lot of competitiveness in this business. There's a lot of jealousies and envy or whatever. And all that's part of it. But what I have found most often is that successful, talented people really like to be around other successful, talented people. Yeah, they might get envious or whatever, but they like to be around that. And they like to applaud it, encourage it, keep it going. It's, you know, the most generous performers I know are very big stars.
Well, Charles was obviously very generous with you to look to his right and say, you should perform, you should do what I do, basically, is what he was saying.
Well, he did. And he said, you're my muse. I'm going to write for you. And wow, that's a gift you don't turn down. You don't turn that down.
Obviously, you were nervous that first time you performed.
Yes.
Do you still get nervous now when you've written something and are performing it?
Always.
Always?
Always.
Really?
I still worry about... It's so funny. Like, every time... I'm going to be doing another one-woman show October 3rd at Birdland, which is where I like to perform. And I literally, every time I perform there, I go, oh, is anyone going to come? I always am nervous that no one's going to buy tickets. Usually it's always sold out, to be quite honest. And Jim Caruso always laughs at me and he goes, no, everyone hates you. No one will be here and you will bomb. And of course, it turns out great and I always have so much fun. That second when they announce your name, right before that, my stomach does do a bit of a flip-flop and I still am going over things. But I do find I like to be super prepared. I think preparation is kind of everything, even when you go off script. Because, you know, when you're doing a comedy act or when you're doing a one-woman show, you do want to be able to go off script a bit, play with the audience, whatnot. But you have to go back. Because I'm actually a storyteller rather than just a traditional stand-up. I don't just stand there and tell jokes. I tell stories and jokes. And then readings as well. But until I get out there and I hear that applause, I'm a bit of a flip-floppy stomach, nervous, you know. One of the great things about having a lot of experience, though, is that you get a pass on a certain level particularly in this community, when you know that there are a lot of performers in the audience, you can make certain jokes that you know if you mess something up, it's kind of like the old Johnny Carson. You just shrug your shoulders and you go, blew that, you know. But you get a pass on a certain level. But yeah, the nerves are always there, particularly when you try out new material. There's, you know, I used to try out new material on, you know, some of my friends or my husband or whatever. And I try not to do that too much because some of my friends are like, are you telling me a story that you're going to tell on October 3rd or whatever? And I don't mean to be that kind of person. But Charles is someone that I can bounce ideas off of. And we are really good with each other that way. And one of the things that's so great about when we collaborated was that I would go over to his house. And I know people are going to laugh about this, but it's really true. He was like, oh, I love the clothes of the 60s. Let's do something in the 60s. Like, it starts with the clothes, you know, or like, he'll be like, look at this wig. Isn't it beautiful? It reminds me of, you know, Joan Crawford in the 1940s. I'm going to write a play about that, you know. So it starts with a wig or a dress or whatever. Okay. But we would sit there and we would just yak. And then we would sort of kind of, he'd say, oh, I think you should play like a countess. And I was like, yeah, a countess who's really a, you know, a stripper on the side, you know. And we just, and he'd start writing things down. And, you know, I would just tell him like, oh, I got to tell you about my day. And we would start talking in the cadence of what we were going to do, like whether if it was going to be a film noir, we would start talking in that kind of cadence. Or if it was going to be a sort of 60s thing, we'd start doing these kind of joke, you know, sort of Twiggy-esque kind of things. So we were just playing. And we would sit in his apartment and play. And then literally, I'm not joking, I would say within like 3 or 4 weeks, he'd be like, hey, here's a new play. And it would come out of our
just that playing with each other,
improvisational yeah. kind of thing. And because he's so talented, it would be a real play. I remember one of his more recent plays was The Divine Sister that we did down at the Soho Playhouse not too long ago, actually. And it took place in the 1960s, but we were nuns. We weren't models. We were nuns. And I think I got to page 3, and I knew it was going to be a hit. I was laughing out loud on page 3. And I just thought, okay, this is it. And of course, you know, it ran 10 months and it was a hit. And it was brilliant. And there actually is interest in that property.
Sure.
He's talking to some people, big people. You know, I'm like, Charles, you know. They would have to put so much Vaseline on the lens at this point if we're going to do this, you know. But anyway, that was fairly recently, and you know, I knew from page 3 it was fantastic, and we got a rave review.
What happened? They can't all be fantastic
right.
and big hits.
Right.
What happens to you as a writer, as a performer, when you're on stage and it doesn't go? Yeah, or you're in a show that. Uh-oh, this didn't work. And you spent a lot of time in that apartment or
yes,
working on that character.
It's hard. It really is. It's actually pretty heartbreaking. And, you know more than anyone, it's a really tough business. Why something lands and why something doesn't land. But, you know, I know this is hard for people because you do have to develop a bit of a thick skin in this industry. And, I mean, I've told stories where I go, wow, that was 5 minutes of kind of near silence. And you kind of go, okay, take it out. You have to be very brutal with yourself. You go, okay, take that out. That story may end up being like a written short story for something else, but that is not going to go in the act. You have to be brutal with yourself. Or if I do a reading that, wow, why did the first half land and the second half didn't? Then you have to go home and you have to study. Bill Irwin, who I worship, I remember years and years ago when he first hit town with, I guess, the Regarda Flight. It was one of his shows that he... I remember reading that if a bit didn't work after he did it on the stage, he would go into the studio at like 11 o'clock at night and rework his you know, bits, as it were. And that's what you have to do.
Jay Leno used to do the same thing with his monologues. He'd do them, he'd go home and watch them over and over again.
Yeah, and go, okay, too long, cut. And you do have to cut your darlings. There is that expression in the theater, cut your darlings, things that you fall in love with that the audience doesn't. Or it's not working, it's not pushing the narrative, it's not helping with your theme, whatever it is. You gotta cut the darlings, save it for something else. There was a great bit in a show we did of Charles's. It was Red Scare on Sunset, I believe, which was all about the McCarthy era, 1950s. And there was a fantasy sequence where Charles was Lady Godiva, and you know, we had this amazing wig, and he was on a horse, and we somehow got this kind of prop and a horse, and he was like sort of suspended from a platform. I mean, it was a riot. Didn't fit the narrative, didn't propel the show further. And he had to cut it. And it was hard because it was a very funny piece on its own, but it didn't really go. It was a fantasy sequence that didn't really belong.
You're so funny, and it seems to come so easily for you, and you could read anything and it'd be funny. But what is the essence of what makes something funny? You know, people try to be funny all the time. How do you do it?
Well, contrast is one thing. Mm-hmm. Contrast. You know, when you're reading something very grand, for example, like you're reading something that Queen Elizabeth has just, you know, decided to read to her, you know, her country, but you read it like this, you know, you read it in a Long Island accent, you know, that's contrast. So that's always funny. So you're already laughing. Clearly, there are people who are just very good at writing cleverly. They just know how to put words together in a very clever way, like a Noel Coward, you know.
Do you do character research when you, like, I want to talk about Gypsy for a second.
Oh, okay.
Because your stripper in Gypsy was just hysterical. She was a little tipsy, if I remember correctly.
She was more than a little tipsy. She was kind of blotto.
Yeah, right. I mean, she really kind of stared all over the place.
Yeah.
But what I loved about that, and really, you know, that was early in my career. And I remember what was great, even better being a company manager, was being able to watch some artists like yourself work. That was nowhere on the page, right?
No.
Nowhere on the page. So not you added the fact that she was blotto, which, as I remember thinking, of course she was blotto. She's a stripper in the vaudevillian age, right?
And she was not young. She was about 40 years old.
Right.
That's what's... I'll tell you honestly about that character development. First of all, Sam Mendes made all of us, write a backstory. He was really tough about it, too. And he was like, I want you to do research. And we had books about the Wichita circuit, the Orpheum circuit. He brought in a lot of research for us. So that was one thing. Plus, at that point, we could actually look things up because the computer age had emerged. So I did a lot of research on that. I looked at a lot of pictures of, you know, carnivals, carnival barkers, carnival girls, showgirls, strippers, those kind of tent shows in the 1930s. What people were doing, where they were living, how they were living. It was pretty hand-to-mouth. It was not glamorous on any level. What those girls looked like, how they were. And I came up with the idea of being a drinker. And Sam thought that was a great idea. He was like, I love it. That's great. We'll get you a prop. What do you drink? And I was like, well, I like to drink wine, so I'm going to make her a wine drinker. He goes, I love it. We're going to make her a wine drinker. But he was the one who said, now, if we're going to have this stripper who's of a certain age, who's on a bad circuit, that circuit is not a good circuit, and you're going to be pretty drunk, I don't want you to move. Now we're going to go back to the text. Now we're going to go back to the lyric. I'm electrifying, and I'm not even trying. I never have to sweat to get paid. He said, it's right there in the lyric. You've created this character, but now we can marry it with the lyric. Because, you know, I'm not a dancer. I'm not a singer. Although I do musicals, which is a riot. But he said, let's somehow marry this. And I guarantee you, if you don't move and you stand there pretty drunk and you literally just light up your costume with difficulty, you will bring the house down. And he was not wrong.
He was definitely right. I mean, I'm laughing right now just thinking about it. I wish we had video on this podcast to show everybody.
Yeah.
Which again goes to that contrast, because we had seen the other strippers doing all their crazy things.
Yes, and they're dancing and singing.
With the trumpet and all the stuff.
Yes,
right?
And one's like a ballerina, right? So she has to have some skills. And not me.
And you just staring off.
But it was in the lyric. I mean, that was what was so smart. He was like, you've created this, but we need to marry it with a lyric. And no disrespect to Arthur Lawrence, the brilliant book writer, who, you know, was tough on us. However, when the revival has been revived again, I have heard that people do now utilize what I created on that stage for Miss Electra. So I feel very proud that we created this sort of archetype now. So now people really don't do much when they literally just stand there and light up. I think that's pretty brilliant.
Another Julie Halston original.
Yeah, it was kind of great.
What's it like for you? You're in Tootsie right now, big Broadway musical.
Yes.
Versus the small cabaret stages. Is it a different type of performance, a different type of energy? Do you like one versus the other?
I love them all. And I when people ask me things about this, I always say, well, whatever I'm doing now, I'm most in love with. But that's not really true. The fact is, I love being on a Broadway stage. Love it, love it, love it, love it. I'm a big performer. I like being on a big stage. However, the thing that's so great about doing your own show, and by the way, I mean, just so that people should know this, when you do your own show, not only is it artistically fulfilling, you know, because I'm doing my own one-woman thing and I don't have to pay musicians or whatever, because it's just me standing up there yakking, you can make real money. I mean, I'm just putting it out there.
There's the entrepreneur in you. This is why you're on this podcast.
Yeah, this is the entrepreneur in me. I'm telling you, I used to make, when I did two shows a week at 88s, Wednesday nights and Saturday nights, and of course that was the days when it was all sort of like cash, I could frequently make as much money as a Broadway ensemble member, just pocketed right in there. Because if you sell out, I would get that door. They've got the drinks. I'm just being real practical now. I'm just telling people, you know, when I play that Birdland, I'm telling you can do well. So that's another reason to start thinking for yourself about these things. Anyway, because I am a big performer and I'm now luckily known as a performer who has a certain persona, the persona being, you know, I think the world is crazy and I'm going to judge it. And I'm going to tell you what my opinion is, which is really a callback to my mother. Many people who come to my shows, my one-woman show, know who I am and they know my persona. However, every time I perform, there's always a number of people in the audience who they've never seen my one-woman show. They might know me from Broadway. They might know me because I was on Sex and the City and I played Bitsy Von Muffling. And they're like, oh, let's see what that lady who played Bitsy is doing. But they all get it. They all get it. And when I'm present doing my one-woman show, that's my favorite place to be. When I'm on the stage at Broadway. That's my favorite place to be. I'm not as comfortable on movie and film when TV sets. I'd like to become much more comfortable on that. But I just recently did an episode of Divorce that Sarah Jessica Parker is in. And because I knew a lot of those people, because a number of them work on Sex and the City, it was such a comfortable set. And Sarah Jessica Parker is such a comfortable, lovely, wonderful human being. It was so comfortable and so fun that became my favorite thing. Do you know what I mean? So I'm always present for what's right in front of me. But if somebody were to say to me, you can never work on Broadway again, like, I don't know, if Broadway exploded or whatever, I don't know, or just you can never, I would be heartbroken. I love being on a Broadway stage in front of a live audience. And musicals are particularly rewarding because you have every element of the creative world. Dancing, singing, an orchestra, amazing sets, and the crews, you know, there's nothing more alluring to me than pushing open that stage door, saying hello. It's Tommy the Fly Guy, you know what I mean? It's like saying hello. All right, Scotty's in the house, you know. I love the crews. I love my hair and makeup people. I'm the whole ritual of Broadway, of theater. It's not just Broadway, it's all Broadway. It's the whole ritual. I go on the stage before we start the show. I love it. Sort of you give it up to the theater gods. I love that ritual. I'm sorry. I love taking that final bow with the cast and hearing that orchestra. It is thrilling. It is something so special, so unique. Why wouldn't I? Do you know what I mean?
This is a great segue to my last question, which is my genie question.
Okay.
I want you to imagine that the genie from Aladdin comes to visit you.
Okay.
Thanks you for making all these people laugh. I mean, you've really given people the ultimate gift, making them forget their troubles, actually without moving in Gypsy, just making them laugh just by standing there. I want to thank you for all that by granting you one wish. You obviously love Broadway and performing so much. But what's the one thing about Broadway that drives you crazy, that actually makes you angry, that would have you flip up this table, that you would wish that this genie would just make disappear like that?
I've got my producer hat on now for
yes,
this question.
Great.
Which is, I'd like to see costs come down because, and that's hard, and I understand that as a producer. I'd like to see theater more accessible to more people. And I'd like to see Broadway shows become more accessible to people. Broadway is the one thing about this city. You cannot get any other city. Broadway is its own unique 12-block radius in New York City. People do come here to see a Broadway show. I wish the ticket prices weren't as expensive. That would be my genie wish, so that instead of a family having to see only one show, right? Because they're here for the holidays and they're gonna go to Top of the Rock or they're gonna do that and they're gonna go to Statue of Liberty or whatever. But I'd like to have them see two or three shows. And how do we make that work?
It's a very good wish. I have one more question
yes.
for you. I just so happen to have a New York Times right here.
Okay.
Would you read something for us?
Of course.
All right.
All
we'll
right.
Just flip it open to, oh, there's a wonderful article on the front. Let's get a brand new Julie Halston reading just for you.
Okay,
exclusive.
This is wild. Has Mapplethorpe's shock worn off? A critic argues that the once taboo photographs have lost their power. 30 years after Robert Mapplethorpe's death, the legend still obscures the photographs. His demise at 42 from AIDS during the height of the American epidemic gave a tabloid stamp to the authenticity of his sexually transgressive art. Right at that time arose the political controversy Well, I don't know how to say it in the British way, but that is...
Well done, Julie Halston,
that's how
everybody.
I read the New York Times.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for being here with us.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you on the Producer's Perspective podcast next time. Once again, a big, big Producer's Perspective podcast thank you to Julie Halston for sitting down with us today and being such a great sport. Speaking of sports, the Super Conference is coming up November 16th and 17th, and yes, that comparison makes absolutely no sense whatsoever, but you get what we're going for. It's the most exciting event of our year here at the Producer's Perspective Super Conference, November 16th and 17th. This year we have two fantastic keynote speakers, Pulitzer Prize finalist Heidi Schreck and Joe Iconis of Be More Chill fame. Two keynotes for the price of one. So join us at the Super Conference. It's going to be a blast. We are going to do some things we've just never done before. And you're going to have a lot of fun and learn a lot in the process. So join us there. Just Google Ken Davenport Super Conference. It'll pop up. If you're excited for this new podcast season, do us a favor. Review us on Apple Podcast. It'll help other theater makers and theater fans just like you enjoy these conversations. And it reaches all over the world. And there are people in places we don't even know about that won't ever be physically here in New York City, get a chance to see a Broadway show. This is their chance to touch it, but they only can do that if they hear about it. Your reviews help them do that. If you want to keep up with Julie Halston all year long, and if you want her to make you laugh all year long, follow her on Instagram, her Instagram handle @actressjuliehalston, just like that. Make sure you're following me on Instagram @KenDavenportBway. It's where I drop all the best announcements of the stuff we're doing early. I do everything there early, before press releases even. And now we get to that final moment. I'm going to leave you with our Songwriter of the Week. That's right, #SongwriterOfTheWeek. Each week here on the podcast, we highlight a brand new songwriter, an emerging songwriter on this podcast. Today, we'll be hearing Zach Zadick's song Sisters from his musical Deathless. If you don't know Zach, that's fantastic. That's why we're playing his tune today. So again, this is Sister Zach Zadick from his musical Deathless. If you like what you hear, you can find more over on his website, www.zadek.com. We love giving some love to all these new writers out there who just want their shows out there in the world. So go to their website, go to Zach's website and check it out. That's it for this week. We will see you next week with a brand new podcast episode. Thanks so much for tuning in and for being such a fan of the theater.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.